Welcome back, Rhetoric Warriors Podcast, teaching America how to persuade America. This is the power of ethical-only persuasion. Complicated times out there, they require sophisticated techniques. So why don't you get your learn on before you go starting to mess with people and do political persuasion? I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, late-night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors, got a new book out, 21 Colosseums of Persuasion. That's what I did during the pandemic. I wrote a book. Check that out. The purpose of the podcast, we do three things here. I talk to comedians about their careers and their politics, and I also uncensor them because comedians have gotten to feel touchy about saying things in clubs because there's so much blowback. So sometimes we talk about that. I convert conservatives on the podcast because they worry me and they fascinate me. So send me a conservative. We'll talk. I'll change their mind. And if you don't want your mind changed, just don't get into a conversation with me because it's going to happen. And I get some persuasion education out there by interviewing persuasion pros, social issue peeps, and more rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast in the world that you'll hear today. That's my claim. My guest this week, I love this person. She's a stand-up here in Austin. Which is being hit by some fascinating forces over the last year during the pandemic with Joe Rogan moving here with his comet tail of comedy store comics trailing behind him. She's also an actor, improviser, does digital marketing, social media management. She's in the paleo world, has a fitness brand and her own new podcast, Detox, where she gets vitamin IVs into the arms of comedians while she interviews them. Funny. Clearly, she stays in shape by doing way too much. Just an awesome person. Allison, say your last name again for me.
Vojtovich. Yeah.
Well, that's easier than I thought.
Yeah, it would help if people just didn't see it before I told them how to say it. Because then it would, yeah, you just smash a keyboard. That's how it's spelled.
Yeah, that name has no place in America. I'm sorry.
Yeah, only in Poland. And they kicked us out of there too, I think.
But is Poland the W? Is the W a V in Poland?
Yeah. Yeah. Always? It sounds similar to Russian. I don't know that much about it, quite honestly. I'm fourth or fifth generation at this point. But yeah, from what I understand, it usually swaps like that.
There are a lot of Slavs and such in Texas. It's one of the secondary areas that was migratory settled. So there's a lot of Germans, a lot of Poles, a lot of Czechs.
Yeah, my parents are from upstate New York, so there's a ton of Polish people up there, and then also Scandinavians, and funny enough, tons of Scandinavians and all that down here too. So
yeah, I mean, right, Braunfels, right, and Wurstfest and all that.
Yeah, stuff. Well, even, I mean, I'm from Round Rock, and like the church that I grew up going to and all that stuff, it was founded by all Scandinavian people. Like there was a whole clan of them up there, I guess. It's probably a bad word to use, but
clan is. Clan's the right word. It's not our fault that these racist assholes took it. You know, a clan's just an extended family. I'm from Kentucky. I've seen a lot of these nomenclatures being stolen and ruined. So you've done it. You're doing tons and you're always doing tons and tons.
It's a wild ride. I didn't tell you this before we went live. My project this week has been fixing my sleep cycle because I was working door at a Bollywood party on Saturday. My roommate's a DJ. And so I was up until like 5 and I've just been staying up that late every single night. So been slowly pushing it back. So that's been my most recent project is just fixing Allison's sleep. Although now you need to stay up late a little with stand up, but
we both traversed some of the same worlds. You're newer into them for some of them. And I've been in them for a long time. But paleo, you know, that what you just said, fixing your sleep cycle, that's clearly paleo talk.
Well, okay. So for me, it's like, I think you just, everyone needs to have a sleep schedule that works for them. And I do typically stay up until like between 12 and 2 every day, because I'm usually out at shows and stuff. And even if I come home at 10 or 11, I'm still kind of reeling and like, got to lower the adrenaline before you can go to sleep. And because I do my own work with the digital marketing, I can sleep in until 10 or whatever I want to the next day. But But staying up until 5 and sleeping until 2 is not what I want to be doing, because I would only have a couple hours to do my marketing before I go to a show.
You'll destroy yourself, like all stand-ups eventually do. It used to be, you know, cigarettes and cocaine and alcohol, and that would take them out. And
now it's weed and cocaine and
so many ways to crash. These worlds. So you're traversing lots of different worlds. So let's focus a little. I'm kind of fascinated right now because I've been around Austin now for almost 10 years again. And when I first got back here, I did a lot in the stand-up scene and then have slowly moved out of it as I got into all this other stuff. But I watch it. And so I've seen, like, let's just set the scene for everybody who's not aware. Austin for a long time has been a mostly amateur stand-up scene, where it's a lot of, you know, decent talent, a lot of people who are working really hard at it, but there's not a lot of money in doing comedy in Austin.
That's the clarification I always like to make with people, because a lot of people that were here pre-COVID get really mad when someone says that. And to a certain extent, I understand, because we had so much stage time, but it wasn't paying enough to sustain a career. And that's what, to me, that's why it still counted as amateur. It was a great local scene to learn how to get good, because there were/are good people here, but there was only one club that would pay you, and they only had so many people that they would book, right? So eventually you needed to either become a road person or move to a bigger city that had more paid opportunities.
Yeah. So instead of calling it amateur, let's call it non-paid.
Yeah.
The non-paid stand-up scene here, right, which is, it's a very strong determining factor. When you're living in LA and New York, a lot of times, sometimes you'll be doing non-paid stuff there too, but it has the context of there's an industry around you. You might get cast, you might get managed, all that kind of stuff. But typically in the rest of the world, you're if you're doing non-paid stand-up, there's a question about whether you're actually a stand-up or not.
And that's like from the perspective of people who do get paid, which makes sense, because you're the professionals, you know, that makes sense. Yeah.
But I totally get Austin. I've always kind of admired Austin for its pluckiness of its, like, hey, we're doing this. We're doing coffee shops. We're doing bars. We don't care. We are going to do stand-up. There's a guy who was here for a while that I loved. His name was Elvis something, and he was from Croatia. I don't know if you ever met Elvis.
I didn't. I would definitely have remembered that.
He has another one of those last names you can't say, so I'm not saying it. But the guy was fearless. And for a while, what he was doing was going around the South to Waffle Houses with an amp and a mic and a mic stand and just walking in and asking the manager if he could do some sets.
That's hilarious.
And I mean, I just really admire that kind of, hey, I'm going to do stand up somewhere.
Wow. I admire that too. I've had someone say that to me before, like when everything was still locked down and I was like, man, I really miss this. Someone was like, why don't you just bring an amp to Zilker Park? And I was like, why don't I just shoot myself in Zilker Park? Like, I'm not Dave Chappelle. Like, I don't want to do that. So, it's definitely interesting. And like, I will say one thing that I mean, any city you go to that isn't a big industry city probably has some sort of an open mic at least, right? And what I really loved about Austin is, like, even though most of our shows were not in theaters or clubs, you know, we would have brewery shows, coffee shops, restaurants, bars, whatever, they were still finding ways to, like, at least pay you a little bit for your set. It definitely wasn't a living wage, but, like, I always found that interesting when I would go to LA or another city that had more clubs than us. Like, Phoenix actually has a ton of clubs too, but there were, the smaller shows didn't even give you like $10 for doing your spot, you know? And I always found that interesting. So I definitely love that about Austin, and it still continues even after this huge boom of, like, even if it's a local show, we're at least going to try and comp you like for gas or something, which is nice.
Yeah. And my perspective on Austin is unfair. I've done professional stand-up from the time when it was in the 80s, when it was easy to get paid. There were very few stand-ups. There were tons of clubs. They paid a lot. And so that's not a representative experience either. It's not like I earned that. It was just there.
You know, I was you were just right one of the place, people willing to do it.
The right time. The guy where I started was a booking agent named Tom Sobel, and he booked 30 clubs around the country and a bunch of one-nighters. And I got to be friends with him. And, you know, he just starts sending me around to clubs. It was not
that's
that
awesome.
Hard to get paid.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, the difficulty in watching stand-ups try to break in and get paid, that's tough stuff.
It's interesting. I mean, I know like hosting and feature gigs, that's also the thing is like, if you're an aspiring comedian, it's not like you get to just one day start making your money at it. It's not like making a career change in any other world. It's like, okay, you work your way up from being an open micer to a local showcaser to maybe clubs want you to host to then feature. And then you get to headline years into it, you know, if you stick around that long. Right. And the pay scale reflects it as such, right?
Ridiculous. It's like that first paid slot of the opener. It's like 125 a week.
Exactly. For the week. Yeah. For the weekend, you know, you're doing six shows and you get like, 150 bucks or something. I did a show as an opener and host at the Tampa Improv, and I was told I was going to get 150 bucks for three shows. And I got excited because one of the shows ended up getting canceled, but they gave me a check for 300. And I was like, oh, you paid me per show. Like, that was groundbreaking. So the bar is very low
right.
when it comes to paying anyone other than the headliner.
I said, I admire Austin for doing its thing regardless. Mm-hmm. It does create a certain type of comedy scene, though. It creates a certain level of approach to what you're doing. Once you lose, like when your money is on the line, when your job and your career and everything else is on the line, every time you go up, you don't go up and meander through a notebook of half-assed thoughts.
Yeah.
You're like, no.
You sharpen the knife.
Yeah. If I meander, the booker back there is going to be like, that son of a bitch is meandering.
Yeah. There's a certain level of experience and self-awareness that you need to have. And I've learned this. I got lucky to have traveled to LA a lot before COVID, but I've learned it even more since LA came to me. Like, there's a certain level you need to be at before you can just go on stage and fuck around at a paid gig. You know, if it's an open mic, that's one thing, you're figuring something out. Cool. But like, there's some people who are funny enough and experienced enough, and maybe they're more personality based or crowd work based anyway, but they're good enough at what they're doing that they can go on stage and say, screw this, I'm going to just mess around for 10 and like see what happens. And it's also funny.
Yeah, they still deliver. It's
that
still
last
a professional
part is
level
the important. Yeah.
Experience. Yeah. There's a big difference in somebody going, and they're searching through their notebook while we're watching. I'm like,
right.
No. No. Yeah. Search before you get on stage. I don't care if you don't have it perfectly crafted down to every word.
Right.
I don't want to watch your mediocre, you know, ramblings. Have some respect for the audience. I know you're not getting paid.
Or the pause and then, well, what do you think? And the audience just doesn't answer.
So go back a little bit. I think you were kind of developing through the Austin scene, and you... One of the things I think it works real well for you is that because you're in marketing and you've got professional corporate life experience, you bring some of that to even your stand-up. You're like, you were organized, you work hard to get gigs, and you work hard to do well at them. And all that was going on. And then pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. And what, about halfway through the pandemic, Rogan moved here, and then some clubs started to open up. So take people through that a little bit.
Yeah. So Austin was very shut down and from like March until, well, venues were very shut down. The city of Austin wasn't shut down that whole time, but venues were prevented from doing their thing from like March until around, I want to say September, October, somewhere in there. And in that summer of 2020, you know, mid-pandemic, like you said, Rogan did move here. And he started talking some of his other friends into moving here, including Brian Redband, who started his podcast and still works with him to some extent. I've become acquaintances with Redband, and he still works with Joe on some stuff, apparently. So he talked Redband into moving here. He talked Tony Hinchcliffe into moving here. He's talked a lot of people into coming to visit. And then once they're here, he's like, yeah, you should move here. And they're like, yeah. So there's this whole thing. And basically, as soon as venues got the green light, you know, when they got the green light, it was still like you have to be distanced and masked to and from your table and all those things. But at least they had the green light to start performing again. And so that's when places started opening back up, including Vulcan, where Big Laugh Comedy is booking. Creek in the Cave had moved to town. around that time when things were opening up. Like they made the announcement a while ago, but they started really working on it. And I think they opened in the spring. And
from New York, right?
From New York. Yeah. They moved down here from New York. The owner, Rebecca, moved it. She got a local co-owner to help with all those things. And then the Romo Room is another one, which is at the Domain. So North Austin. And that one, I don't remember when they switched it to more showcasey style, but they were trying to make it like a slotted mic pre-COVID, which is a very common thing in LA. You pay $5 to get your 10 minutes on stage. You're done in an hour. And the Austin comedians just had a heyday getting mad at them for charging people to do open mics. And I get both sides, you know, comedians don't make a lot of money and then they, you know, are charging you for time. But at the same time, what you're paying for is the guarantee that you get 10 minutes and then you're done in an hour. You're not wasting your time for 4 hours at an open mic, whatever. Romo Room converted to an actual comedy club to some extent within the Brass Tap at the Domain, but booking bigger headliners like Sam Tripoli and Godfrey came through and, you know, people like that.
Yeah. I think my buddy, Jimmy Schubert's going to be there sometime
soon. Yeah. Yeah. They've been booking a ton of people. So that's probably, and then Sunset Strip moved here from LA. It was a couple of guys that were in LA and I don't actually know what they were doing in LA. Like, I think they had a club, but I don't know what it was called. Maybe it was also called Sunset Strip. Adam Hartle's one of the co-owners. And they started doing shows also like probably later than February of this year. So like by the time April hits, we have 4 clubs here, and then Cap City partnered with Helium to come back. So that'll be a 5th club. We have Rogan is opening a spot. That'll be a 6th club. And then there's still the local places that are like more clubby theater-esque. So the Velveeta Room is a stand-up comedy club on 6th Street. And then Fallout Theater does a lot of improv, but also some stand-up shows. So there's a ton of like, quote unquote, professional places here in town now. And especially the new ones, since they came in knowing that Rogan was bringing all these other people in, they started really booking the LA and New York people that were coming through to visit and actually making it a moneymaker. So once those bigger names started coming through and selling tickets and getting, for lack of a better word, the clout to those locations, all of the shows started selling more tickets and local shows are able to pay now and all that stuff. It was funny. I ran into someone yesterday that was like, I saw you got to do Creek in the Cave. That's a huge deal. And I was like, I've done like, I don't even know how many shows there at this point, because that's the one club right now that runs like a comedy club. It is 7 days a week. There are multiple shows. Some of them are local. Some of them are like booked headliners, all that stuff. And so, but like the cool thing is they're selling tickets. It's not just like they're saying free show, come to this. And that's what Austin was beforehand. A lot of it was free show. We'll take some tips and that's how we'll pay the performers. But now it's like, no, you're paying $10+ per show to go see, even if it's a local showcase. So then the smaller guys like me get to still get paid somewhat. But yeah, that's kind of what happened is COVID shut everything down. Cap City announced it was closing, which was our only comedy club. And so everyone was upset. And then suddenly 4 clubs appeared because Rogan moved here. And yeah, we were one of the first states to even allow live performance again. So it made sense that people would come to a place like Austin where it's kind of a blend of liberal Texans, you know?
Yeah, it is kind of fascinating again, when most people don't even understand that stand-up is a business and it's an odd business. But, you know, trying to run a club and trying to figure out what draws people in, what to charge, you know,
right,
how much free stuff to do, how much, what quality level of talent that you need to get people satisfied and to come back again, all these things right. play in. And like I said, Austin's always had, I think it's always had a good talent pool. Most of the talent that rises up and professionalizes goes elsewhere. So
right.
it's always draining its own talent pool. And the professionals here that live here and stuff never went out. They were never really part of the scene because it was so mobbed by non-pro comics.
Yeah, there was that weird thing pre-COVID and somewhat now still, but pre-COVID, I always described it as 3 buckets. There were the people who climbed the ranks within Austin and got to be pretty good. You know, they were booked on a lot of local shows. Sometimes they were doing Cap City. Sometimes they might even headline Cap City, but they were like a local legend and they were happy with that. You know, they weren't looking to be professional comedians elsewhere. They'd take the money when they got it, but they had a day job and they were good at stand up, but they weren't trying to like go get a Netflix special, you know?
Yeah, so they just didn't know how to do it.
There was that. Okay, sure.
But always, they always went.
Yeah. And then there was the crew of actual, what I would call actual professional comedians who were not famous, but they were road dogs. You know, they would get booked all over the country on comedy clubs. And I say actual professionals because, again, they're making their living at stand up. So
even though they're Browse, Matt Sandler.
Yes, Mike McCray, exactly. Yeah. And they're very funny, but they're not hyper famous. And I don't know that they ever really want to be. Right. And so there's those.
Yeah, they do. They just don't know how to do it. That's one of the things about stand up as an occupation. It doesn't matter. If you're at the top of it, you're like, oh, I should move over and do drama. I mean, that's what you see with comedians. Like suddenly Jim Carrey's at the top of $20 million movies. And he's like, nah, I want to do drama.
Oh, my God.
Stop and just stand on top of the mountain, dude.
Enjoy it. Yeah.
Don't look at another mountain and go, that's not your mountain, buddy.
And then the third pool was the people who would learn how to do stand up here. They would get good. They would start headlining the shows locally and then decide I'm going to take the jump to a place where I really could go get an agent or get a special or something like that. And they would move to LA or New York.
Well, you forgot the fourth bucket.
The eternal open micers.
The eternal open micers who clog everything and make the experience horrible for the, you know, audience who tries to sit through it.
Yeah. But yeah, so there was like the crew of people who were like, I mean, like you mentioned, the road guys like J.R. Brow, Mike McCray, like those guys, like everyone knows who they are because they're hilarious and good, but they wouldn't come to open mics because number one, they have enough paid gigs that they can work on new material there and they're good enough that they can do that. Number two, because you're right, the list was long, full of people who were just stuck in that first stage.
But it's not really elitism. It's more like you hang out with people that are kind of within your level. And I think most standups are fairly generous, like even the Ron Whites and guys like that. When they run into people that are early and trying to get into it, they'll talk, they'll hang out, yeah, they'll give advice and stuff like that. It's part of the community of standup. But if that's all you're doing every time you go out, it gets kind of old. Like, you want to hang out with your buddies and, you know, you don't want to be the old guy giving advice all the time. It's like, come on.
There's that for sure. Yeah, it is a good thing about stand-up. Like you mentioned it, like I come from the acting world and I haven't really done any auditioning the last couple of years, but I would do more acting, you know, if the right audition popped up. But the thing that I love so much about stand-up is because the barriers are a lot lower and you like, I mean, being positioned where I am, I don't reach out to these big names and like ask them for advice, even though I see them all the time or I'm in the green room with them all the time. But if they offer it to me, I'm always just so like thankful and humbled and reminded that this is a really cool industry. Like if someone is a professional stand-up comedian, most of the time they meet a young person and they're just like, oh yeah, I remember being where you're at. Let me just talk to you for a second, you know, especially if you're not bothering
lives
them.
Are so meaningless. You know, they've got to find some way of feeling good about themselves. I helped that person. Like I said something to Chappelle back in 1977 and that's why he's famous now.
Oh yeah. That's why.
Stand-ups are great. I love the stand-up community. And even, you know, you and I have kind of, One of the ways we met each other was I started doing, you know, I've always taught classes. I was a professor, mm-hmm. so I can't help but abstract things. And then when I, you know, teach that stuff to people, and it's such a mixed bag, you know, when you try to do that, because especially in places like Austin, but stand-up in general is a rebellion culture.
Yeah.
You know, it's a cynical culture. It sees scams and everything. And it's control freaks. They don't want to be told anything.
Right.
So trying to work with that community, you know, once they get in, they go, oh yeah, I guess there's a lot of shit I don't know, but you know, they just want to discredit everything. And it's hilarious to go, guys, you just, why shoot yourself in both feet, both arms, both legs, and then wonder why you're not succeeding in the business. Like every other area of the business, they have managers, they have coaches, they take classes. Like, can you imagine an actor just saying, no, I just act. That's just how I do it.
It's the weirdest combination of like self-loathing and ego. at the same time. Like, there's so many comedians that will just talk about their mental health issues, whether on stage or not. They'll just talk about how much they hate themselves or their lives or their choices. And at the same time, you try to give them advice to help change those things. And then they're just like, fuck you, you don't know anything. And it's very strange.
That's exactly it. That's the exact description. Self-loathing. They understand that they're losers and you try to help them. They're like, how dare you try to help me?
Yeah.
Fascinating. So have you seem like the person, I think, that has walked, you know, the Moses waters right in between these two worlds, where I don't think you've become a pariah to the Austinites, and you seem to have, you know, found some good space, be able to talk to the city guys, the city comics who have made their way here. You're kind of walking the middle.
I'm figuring it out. Like, I was like, wait, I haven't become a pariah yet. We'll see.
It's easy. It's like, a pariah. Look, they're looking for pariahs.
Yeah. I feel like I've always kind of walked that line though, because like I mentioned, I was not that far into stand-up when I started going to LA just to like check out what it was like there. One of my best friends used to live there, so I had a free place to crash. It's cheap to fly out there, you know? So I would go out every other month, every third month or something like that, and just hit the mics, you know, maybe get like a local show somewhere, like at a bar, you know, they have those in LA too, something like that. But just to kind of check out what it was like in a place where people were moving there because they wanted that to be their job. And that was something I always respected about LA comedians, is like, they aren't afraid to talk about the business side of it. And you can hate it as much as you want, but you need the business side in order to make the money to make comedy your job.
Right.
And
it's not a bad thing there. Everybody's working the industry because it's a complicated, and it's a networky industry. Every job I ever got, I got into the Writers Guild. I was on 3 network shows, and I got every single one of them through a stand-up I knew from before Hollywood, who was on staff there and took my writing packet into the head writer.
Well, that's the thing too, is like, there's a lot of the sentiment of, I hate the industry. Like, you have to know someone to get in. And I'm like, that's how every industry works. I worked in the fitness industry. Find me a place
you used to walk in. And
I worked in the fitness industry. I work in marketing, and now I'm in comedy. And whenever people ask me how I get new marketing clients, I just say it's referrals. Like, I did a good job with one client, either our contract ends or they keep me, but they're like, hey, I have a friend who needs you too. And then that's how, you know, and that's how it is. It's just, you build relationships with people, and it's not sleazy. It's just, I'm much more likely to refer my roommate, the DJ, to work your party than some random person I found on Facebook Marketplace to do your party, you know,
and being good. I try to explain this to a lot of comics here too. And there's just too much ground to cover for people who haven't had any industry experience to the level of getting hired. There's too much ground to cover educationally. So I stopped doing it. But I had guys come in and they were talented stand-ups, good writers, and they wanted writing jobs. And I'm like, great. I said, I get it. I was in the exact same position. You've got to put together a writer's packet that will impress a professional head writer.
Right.
Not your buddies.
Yeah.
Not anybody, you know, that knows you. And I've been a professional head writer, so let's get you a packet that impresses me.
Right.
Now, it doesn't mean it's going to work with every single head writer, but I promise you it will have been vetted by a head writer.
Right.
And so they would give me something, and there'd be one joke in there I kind of liked out of 30. And I'd be like, well, this one's good. Let's do another submission until we get a, you know, 15 or 20. Mm-hmm. And they'd be like, no, that there's a lot of good jokes in there. I'm like, okay. Then you go send it in.
Yeah.
Send it in, lose their op. And
their chance,
look at me like, I didn't, you know, it was unfair. I'm like, no, you weren't ready.
Well, yeah. And you did your job of trying to tell them, like, this literally used to be my job. You need to impress me first. I'm not gatekeeping in a bad way. I am gatekeeping to your benefit jokes.
I'm open. I'm positive. I used to say, you should not be able to get to me. Like, literally. If I hadn't left Hollywood and raised my kids here in Austin and kind of pivoted out of full-time writing, I'm like, you would have never have gotten to me. Like, some guy in Austin, some stand-up in Austin, I don't even know. I would have never looked at your shit.
True though.
Yeah, value this. Like,
yeah.
I would have died for that opportunity when I was 25 and trying to break into the business, but they look at me like, "Hey, what do you know?" I'm like, "Okay,
totally." Right. Yeah. So I mean,
okay, so you're walking the line. Here. You're
walking
not,
the
you're
line
trying
is
not to be pariah, although who gives a shit about the Austin community and their pariahness? Really?
Well, I've realized one of my greatest character pieces and also flaws is that it makes me really sad if someone is genuinely mad at me. And I think as soon as I launched this podcast, I was like, I'm a sensitive girl. Be nice to me, please.
Oh, you're likable, and you know, you've worked that your whole life, right? You know how to be likable and you're comfortable there.
People are always like, why do you smile so much? I'm like, because I just smile a lot. I'm not even trying.
I'm happy.
You know? I'm just happy.
I went up after a Houston comic once that was in that sort of Sam Kennison posse.
Yeah.
Bill Hicks posse, where it's just like, let's tear the world apart from stage. And he was just going off about something. Maybe it was Britney Spears, like for 10 minutes or something.
Oh,
I
God.
Walked up and I'm like, yeah, I'm just not that unhappy. I'm not going to. Yeah.
That's literally a thing I told people when I first started. I was so scared to do stand up because I was like, I don't, it's really hard to make me mad. Like, truly, it's hard to make me mad. And it's hard for me to get worked up on over an opinion that I have, because I hear my super liberal friends make a claim and I'm like, that makes sense. And then I hear my super conservative friends make a claim and I'm like, that also makes sense based on who each of you are and who I know each of you are and your experience. I understand why you believe that. And then now I'm not mad at you, because it's just what we believe. Like, I you as a person, I still like to hang out with. So it's just really hard to actually get me riled up, even if it's something that I really care about.
Oh, like, you and your healthy psychology.
It's
how dare
so
you
I was
be
like,
happy
I'm not
and flexible.
Be, I was like, I'm not going to be funny because I don't have strong opinions. I've figured out certain things that I have strong opinions on that maybe one day I could get into that mindset of whatever. But it's like,
that
I don't
is
know.
Not the pinnacle of stand-up.
It's not the pinnacle.
Having
but it
strong
seems like that.
Opinions about the world is not the pinnacle of stand-up. Although it's become like, because it sort of adds a power level to stand up where you're like, I'm changing the world. Yeah, you're not changing shit. You know, you're a comic saying some words on a stage.
Yeah.
Get people laughing to the point where they're like, that was worth paying for.
Exactly.
And then you've accomplished your goal.
Yeah. So I've been lucky so far, because I was never like besties with any of the Austin comics, really. I had a couple friends, you know, that were good friends and stuff, but I wasn't one of those people who was staying out every single night with them or like getting invited to the house parties or things like that. So I was on good terms and we would hang out if we were on shows together. I'd go to the bar where everyone would hang out on nights that I was out, but I wasn't like, it wasn't my best friends. And so I think I just hit the right thing to where it was like, they know me well enough. They know I'm nice. They know I don't mean like any harm. And at the same time, I think the Austin scene did see how much I was going to LA, like to the point where some of my friends from college that still live here in Austin were asking me how LA is, because they thought I moved there. Okay. So like, I was there enough that people weren't really sure, even though I was running two shows here and like going
again,
to
that's
any,
good
all
business
that shit.
Sense. You were doing some research. You're trying to understand an industry.
Yeah. And it was cool because once the LA people started moving here, I already knew who most of them were. Even if like we'd never met, I had either seen them on one of the local shows that I went to, seen them on a mic somewhere, been to the store and seen them drop in. Like, I knew who the people in the scene were in LA. So when they started coming here, it was like, oh, cool. This just feels like a blend of the two comedy scenes I know the most of.
Nice. Talk about that a little bit. The kind of immigration. I guess it was legal immigration of California. And it's all comedy store types, which
is
a very distinct type of LA comedy.
Yes.
It's not like the Laugh Factory. It's not like the Improv. It's its own thing. And it's
darker. There's a couple Laugh Factory Improv people that have moved here. Like Bill Dawes is here now. Super nice. Adam Ray's come through a lot. And he does the store too, though. So he's just kind of everywhere. But the comedy store is like, they are honestly, it's, this is going
to
sound
so harsh.
I used
to call it the comedy morgue. It felt like a morgue.
This
like,
is going to sound
black. You walk in there and it's like,
It's going to sound so harsh, but they like to push the buttons that the Austin comedians tried so hard to get rid of completely. So like, And I would describe this to people all the time because I would be asked what it's like to go to LA and do stand up. And I'm like, it's better than Austin in some ways. Like, it's not, the audiences are definitely not as interested and it's not better in that way, but you can push edges and push boundaries in like there were so many words banned from the Austin scene before COVID. And I'm not saying that like you have to be able to say those things to be good, but it does put a level of stress on a comedian to not even breach certain subjects if words are banned, you know? So you go to LA and they're saying all the banned words and it's hilarious because they're doing it in a funny way and they're doing it because they know people are trying to ban them. Like, that's the other thing is these LA comics don't mean anything they say. If they say a derogatory word, they're saying it because they know it's a funny word that pisses people off now. And that's why they're saying it. It's just like you said before, they're the people that have problems with authority. They're the people who want to just do what they want. And so if you tell them they can't say a word, they're going to say that word 15 times in a 5-minute joke, you know? Yeah. So it's been very interesting because I think I've noticed like it had a trickle down effect. For sure, there's some people who see LA comedians saying the quote unquote bad things or like talking about subjects that are insane, like abortion or rape and like all these things that, you know, are touchy subjects when you're talking about them seriously. And there's definitely a certain category of open micer who is taking those things too far and it's not funny. They're just saying it because they want to talk dirty and be rude. But I've also seen it like take some of the weight off of the shoulders of the open micers and even the local showcase people and all that to where they're like, oh, I can joke about these things and I'm not necessarily going to get not booked because of it. Like that was the thing in Austin for a long time. If you joked about those things, you weren't going to get booked. And so you just didn't joke about those things because you wanted to get booked. And now that's not the thing anymore. Like there's not just one crew of Austin people gatekeeping. There's a bunch of different people from different parts of the country moving here who all have their own little nook where they work. So you kind of get to fall into the crew that works best for you.
Right. And that again goes back to like LA. It separates itself into like the improv is just professional guys. And it's a lot of faded celebrities to come through, you know, the improv. And you go down there and see some great comics. I mean, they all do the improvs, but then there's a bunch of, you know, it's also a celebrity based, management company that does that because they have access to those guys and a name will fill up your room, no matter whether it's Chris Kattan or whatever 9,000 years ago he was on Saturday Night Live, but they'll use some of that stuff and that's fine. It is what it is. But then like the, you know, the Laugh Factory is a little bit more about finding new comics and the new voices and has its own choices. And then the Comedy Store had that old Mitzi Shore tradition of darkness and kind of hard, you know, all the way from prior on up to like, hey, who can go into the hardest topics and still be so clever and so artful that they can just crush it,
right?
Come up with some angle that nobody's ever thought of. And just then even the you know, the people who are so sacrosanct and touchy have to laugh.
Right.
Because it's so fresh.
A good way like to describe it too is I mean, Rogan's a store guy. He talks about it all the time. He's been doing some headlining shows at Vulcan and I finally got to watch one a couple weeks ago and he had a great set. You know, he's working on his hour. He's figuring out what order to put things in. And he has jokes anywhere from making fun of gay people to how short he is to how ridiculous his wife is with certain things. Like he's got all these different jokes about all these different things. And at the end of his set, he opens the floor for 10 minutes for Q&A. And, you know, people are asking dumb shit and it's funny. And he like does a running joke on the answer is just your mom's pussy, you know, just dumb shit like that. He's messing with people and it's a good time. And then this one woman raises her hand that he picks on and she just goes, when are male comedians going to stop degrading women and calling it comedy? And, you know, the audience is like, boo. And Joe's like, no, quiet. And he's like, did you think my set was derogatory towards women tonight? And she goes, yes. And he talked her through it to the point where at the end of the conversation, she was laughing at something someone next to her said. And Joe was like, okay, he just cracked a joke on me. Now are we good? Like, see, he's like, I talked about all this shit tonight. And like, yeah, some of the jokes were derogatory towards women, but they were also on all these other things. And you're not mad about any of those. And so I just liked it because like, you know, his his material made her laugh sometimes. And then the subjects that were touchy for her, he was still able to like have a conversation with her afterwards and make her realize how silly she was being. Like it was just a joke type thing. And I think that store energy kind of allows for that too. Like it allows for conversation, you know, it might be a great joke and everyone but that one lady is laughing. And then the comedians will still be okay with talking to her afterwards and like seeing what the deal is. And it's not like you have to chase down every person like that, but a vibe like that at least allows for conversation. You don't have to always agree or think the person's funny afterwards, but at least it allows for conversation. And I don't think there was much room for that before.
You know, as stand-up has gotten more and more familiar in the culture and broken out of the comedy clubs and more into the real, you know, the serious world, the dramatist world and stuff like that. When dramatists or seriousists come after stand-up, I'm like, you know, that's not really the point. Like, this is not me beginning a dialogue. This is me saying something that I think is funny. It's not me trying to change the culture. Even if I say I'm trying to change the culture, I'm not, because I'm not an activist. I'm a comedian. And so it opens up all these issues. And then the disappearing wall between the audience and the performer that now is there because of either live shows or because of social media, you know, complicates things incredibly. And I try to stay out of it because I don't find it that interesting. You know, I find it more interesting, the art of the stand-up, like whatever you choose to do. I don't care if you're a mime with a bulldog up on stage. Do you do that format really well? Like, do you do it artistically enough that you pull off the choices, the area that you've chosen to work in? And if you can, if I can say, yeah, I see the art in here, then I'm fine. I don't care if it's the darkest thing or the, you know, most cheesy thing. I could care less.
Right.
But the audience getting involved in that, I'm like, hey, here's the response that you have as the audience: laugh or silence.
Right.
I don't want to hear your reactions, your evaluations of the jokes.
It is funny that heckling seems to be more and more of a problem, or even just shit like that, where he does let the audience ask questions and then they use it as a chance to try and nail him with something. Like, you see so many videos of stand-up comedians destroying hecklers going viral, and yet more people than ever think it's an okay thing to do.
Yeah, but they're not showing you the ones where the audience destroys them.
Yeah, you know? It's fair.
All that stuff. Like, it's one of the reasons I could care less about doing club stand-up anymore is just alcohol plus that kind of advanced audience aggression.
Yeah.
I'm like, I get it. And I can make you look really bad and I can win this, you know, battle. Trust me, I've got the microphone and I've been doing this for 30 years. You're dead in the water, but I don't want to.
Right.
I don't want to talk about your stuff. We'll talk about my stuff.
That's why I'm up here. This is my time.
Control freak. I set the agenda here. So, that's cool. Like, what do you think is going to happen? Where's this going? Like, is the Austin audiences, are they still going to pay when the music comes back? Because the problem before was there's so many entertainment options here with the music scene was so good and, you know, so varied that the comedy scene really couldn't compete.
Mm. I never even thought of it that way. Now that you say it, that makes sense. I do think there's space for both. It'll be interesting to see once Cap City comes back and once Rogan opens his club. I don't think there's going to be a problem at the other clubs of like booking people still, because there's so many people coming to town. And on that
come
same
and be
note,
disappointed in the Austin comedy scene. Try to make money here and come back and talk to me 6 months later.
I think there's also just so many new non-performers moving to town. Like, and stand-up is very popular in the tech world, which is very interesting. But like, as someone who works in marketing, I know a lot of people in the startup industry and the tech stuff here in town, and all of them listen to Joe Rogan, at least, if not multiple comedy podcasts. And so I think we're lucky in the fact that the demographic of people moving here typically is a podcast fan and has the money to go to shows and wants to go to shows like that. And so I think even if like you know, all the concert venues come back and things like that, it's still kind of two different vibes that it's attracting. And you, I mean, I would fall into both. I would definitely want to go see a comedy show or go watch a concert at Stubbs. But it's giving people the option to do either now. And it still is similar to bands coming to town to a certain extent, you know, unless it's one of the famous people who lives here and does shows all the time. It's still like you only have this weekend to come see that person. So, yeah. Okay, well, this weekend, like that comedian's in town, so I'm going to that. And the next weekend, this band is in town, so I'm going to that. And it'll just be more entertainment options. So I don't think like the music industry is going to be what kind of messes it up. I think maybe having too many clubs could mess it up, but we still have yet to see. And there's also the fact of location, you know, like Cap City and Roma Room are going to be North Austin. There's a couple clubs downtown. And then I don't know where Rogan's going to put his, but there's also kind of that too. The geography will probably help a little bit as well. But
have you avoided so far being sideswiped by any of the kind of ugliness of the city comedy scenes? Like they're harsher. There's no doubt. Like the New York scene, you know, is kind of unforgiving and it's kind of famous even before the whole Me Too thing with Louis C.K. and all that stuff about it's tough to be, you know, just a regular human being there, especially a regular female human being. And most of the, you know, female comics that come through that stuff get so calloused and they can protect themselves. You know, they can hold their own with these comics. But I saw it like with, I thought, you know, with Amy Schumer, some like from her early career to when what she became after, you know, touring with Jim Norton and some of these guys. And I'm like, good God, you know, I get it. And you're talented enough to have adapted and survive and get those guys off your case for not talking about, you know, easy topics.
Right.
But have you been sideswiped by any of the sort of more brutal form of, you know, stand up, city stand up?
What do you mean by that? About
you're not going after topics enough. You're too lightweight.
Oh, no, not really. Not really yet. I've definitely, I'm not going to lie. I definitely need to sit down and write more material. Like I've got, since COVID, like, I mean, I was only a year. I was almost 2 years into stand-up when COVID hit. So I'm still a baby in this shit. Like I'm technically 3 years in, but one of those was COVID and I didn't get on stage for like 9 months. So when I was able to hit the stage again, I kind of revisited old bits that like had promise, but weren't that great. And I reworded them and I fixed them or shortened them into one-liners or something like that. And then, I definitely have new material, but not as much as I want to. And yeah, I mean, I think what I've been doing so far is more silly. And I actually wouldn't even say like it was the new people that sideswiped me. If anything, it was my friend Jay Whitecotton.
He was a local guy. For Jay Whitecotton.
He's a super dark comedian, road guy, but he
Joe Black Cotton. That's what he's dark cotton.
He's very nice and I think he's funny, but his jokes are so dark and he's lived quite a dark life, which explains why his jokes are like that. And
well, it's like kind of JT Haberstadt or whatever his name is, that kind you know, dark punk.
Yeah. Comedy. I would say and a lot of people will say this about Jay, like if you let him sit down and talk to you about comedy, he will not stop and he will tell you what he thinks about you. And it's never like mean. He'll tell you the truth. Like if there's certain qualities that show through when you're on stage or there's habits that are bad that you're doing or certain aspects of your personality that rub people the wrong way. It's not like he's saying you're a dick, you're this, whatever. It's like, this is how people perceive you. And this is why you're not getting booked. Or this is why you're not getting a laugh on that joke, is because actually you look like this or whatever. And he'll go into it with you. And I had like a 3-hour conversation with him a few months ago and clarified a lot of things about how people perceive me and what I'm currently doing on stage. And it wasn't like upsetting at all. It was just clarifying, you know? And so I think after that conversation, it's kind of gotten the wheels turning a bit more for me of like, okay, I love my silly jokes. A lot of them are wordplay. A lot of them are just like, a lot of them turn darker or grosser than I expect them to when I start writing them, but it's just because the wordplay is there. And I think it's funny. But at the same time, it's not like I'm going up there and really like telling an actual like true story about myself or, again, something I believe in. And I'm more along the lines with you of like, I don't actually need to tell you guys anything real about me as long as it's funny. But it did get my wheels turning of what do I actually believe? What's something that I actually believe that would be funny to people? What's something about how I grew up that would be funny to people, you know, and you and I have talked about that before too, because I look like, I don't know, I look like a spoiled sorority girl who has never worked a day in her life. And then I act like a tomboy and go hunting and actually work most of the days of my life.
There's some stuff in your biography that would be interesting to people, some clashes.
Yeah.
I remember when Ashley Barnhill, do you know Ashley?
I know who she is. Yeah. I think I actually met her at Creek when she was in town last time.
Yeah. She took a class from me way back when, and before she even got into stand up, and she likes really dark, really hypersexual humor. And she looks like, you know, at the time, I think she was in law school at UT. And she looks like a sorority girl, and she loved to play those two things against each other. And which I think can be really powerful when you're playing against your type.
Yeah. You know,
there are a lot of comedians in the South, and there's some real interesting talent in the South that most people never even get to see, but there is a whole crew of grandmas from hell, like incredibly dark, uncomfortably sexual comedians who play a grandma character and get up and be like, I want to suck you off. And everybody's like, oh my God, did you just say that?
That's hilarious. Yeah. Southern comedians are their own, like they're funny, but they're very famous in the South. And then they just don't trickle up into the North as much. Cause it's not even, not even because it's just Southern humor. It's just, I don't know what it is, but I mean, if you're killing it in the South, you don't even need to go to New York. Like, why deal with the weather?
Well, it used to be, you know, the South is so regionalized that you could just go around and you had a nice little run of clubs and you could do those and make your million and a half a year. And why do more than that? I mean, they killed it on merch. They get booked easily. It was near their house. They had friends there. So, and there's some great comics that came through there, but it's very regional. And, you know, you get into the dialect problems of people. Like Tim Wilson was a great comic out of Georgia. And he, you know, was on the Tonight Show. And I watched the Tonight Show set because everybody loved him. Even the people in the bigger part of the industry kind of knew who he was because he's been around for a long time. And I could barely understand him. He's on the Tonight Show.
I was wondering if that was it.
High Southern, you know, Georgian accent. I'm like, dude, you don't talk like that in real life.
That's how Rocky Dale Davis is. Rocky Dale Davis is from Brookwood, Alabama. And I had him on my podcast and he's like, I don't have an accent. I don't know what you're talking about. And I was like, Rocky.
If you're from the South, you know far more arcane, you know, the accents go way down the road.
Yeah.
You know, you'd be like, I sound like nothing. Go talk to somebody from Pikeville, Kentucky, and you want to hear an accent.
I know. Well, I tell people, I mean, most people are like, oh, you don't have an accent. And sometimes it slips through and I say y'all, or I've said like fixing to before. And I was like, shit, you know, but I also, can go into it though. Like if it used to be a problem when I would, like, I don't really drink that much anymore. So like, if I was drinking, it would get worse then, or I would, if I got mad, and again, I don't get mad that often. So I didn't even really figure this out about myself until like high school. But if I got mad, I'd be like, you know, just super, super text and get into it. And then like, it's a little different than like, you know, the Alabama, but it's like, it's still there, you know?
Well, you know, and you talk about like Jay Whitecutt and giving people feedback. And, you know, I've worked as a producer forever. And even within stand-up, because I would teach classes and talent would come through there and you could see that they could make a living in this, that there were things that they did really well. And there were things about their character that would be marketable, you know, even in Hollywood. And a few of those guys went on and had, you know, pretty good careers. Like Retta came through my workshops and she was on Community and she's headlining one of the three actresses on Good Girls. And
fuck yeah.
You know, and she was just so, she just had such a presence, you know, and you could tell it immediately. And so I just wrote a bunch of stuff for her. I'm like, here, just take it. And she immediately went out and started making a living with it.
Oh, that's awesome.
But when you see stuff like that, and I stopped doing this years ago, and this is why I always tell people, like, I don't do things for free for comedians anymore, because they can't do it. They can't value it. They can't see it. They can't subject themselves to it. So the only thing you can kind of do is, like, you're going to pay me this amount of money and I'm going to give you this, and it's going to move you up in this way.
Right.
And some of them will kind of do that, but, like, it got to be so unrewarding to try to help people. There's a great comic here in town. I love this guy, Andy Ritchie. And he was with Ruby. I can't remember her last name. She's a great comic too. Just really funny young people. And Ritchie came up with this character called, what was it called? Something, the insult stuttering gravy, the stuttering insult, Southern insult comic.
Oh my gosh.
And he did it at the Austin Film Festival, or not the Austin, but the funniest person in Austin contest, and crushed.
Yeah.
Like, as soon as he went up, he'd be like, that's right in the front. And he'd be like, 1985 called and wants their shirt back. Just killed me. And I was like, oh, that's so good. And I went up to him afterwards. I'm like, hey, man, you know, I don't, you know, connect people this closely very often, but, you know, I know the blue collar guys and I know their manager a little bit. They would love that character. Like, you could go up and open for them, you know, 10,000 seat theaters, you know, and I would love to try to connect you.
Right.
And he's like, I don't want to do that. He goes, no, I don't want to do that character. And I'm like, ugh.
I realize this
I think
is
that
an
was when I stopped
podcast. Like,
trying
I just
to
made
help
the
Austin
face.
Comics.
Yeah.
Like, you're saying, like, no to an instant massive career, because you don't have to do that character all the time.
No.
That'll get you popular, get in front of millions of people, and then do whatever you want, dude.
Yeah.
But now you wouldn't
do it. Wow. That's really upsetting. It's also like, I mean, so, not to, like, just focus in on my career, but I think about that, like, in the context of what I've gotten to do so far, because, like, I got to open a tour when I was a year in, you know, I was definitely not a headliner.
Yeah.
But,
you made a good connection with that lady. What's her
name? But I made a good connection. Her name's Jen Fulweiler and she's awesome. And I mean, her special's on Amazon Prime. Like, she crushed it. Like, she figured out how to do stand up, even though she was not famous for stand up, but now she is connected with all the stand up people. She's represented by UTA, like, all that shit. And I definitely felt some confusion and probably even anger from people who knew that I had not been doing it that long. But there's also the thing that no one really considered, where it was like, she came to me knowing that I was pretty green, but
she was pretty green. She hadn't,
but she was pretty green. And she had not done a stand-up tour, but she was a public speaker for years. Her writing was always comedic. And so it was easy for her to watch a ton of stand-up specials and, like, learn how to translate that over into her own life and learn how to structure a joke. Like, she studied this like a crazy person. I mean, no one works harder than her.
Yeah.
No one works harder than her. And something that I think a lot of people don't even consider is, like, there weren't very many people she could even go to ask for what she needed. Like, she knew that I could, first of all, she needed a clean 15.
Yeah. You're clean.
Like, I'm definitely not clean on my own stuff, but I could do a clean 15.
Right. And you're not conflict driven.
I'm not conflict driven. I wasn't going to show up to the shows on any sort of substances. I could help her with the business side of things. That was a big part of it. She was self-booking her own first tour. So she was putting all those theaters on her own credit card. She was having to run the Facebook ads, like, all that stuff. And I know those things. So we would have business meetings and talk about it. And, like, sometimes we would get together to write comedy. Sometimes we would get together for tour planning. And it was, like, both things. And so it's like,
yeah, that's awesome. That's a great double offer. Yeah.
Yeah. And you don't get, like, bringing it back to the story you just said, like, there's a certain opportunity that you get based on your own skills sometimes. And that just felt to me like, if Jen had come to me and been like, hey, I want you to do all these things, which was an amazing experience and totally helped me with my career. And then just me being like, no, I don't want to do a clean 15. Like,
that's exactly right. Exactly right.
That's so frustrating.
Again, I get it. They're stand-ups. They kill their own stuff. Like, I know so many stand-ups will say something funny to me. I'm like, oh, that's a funny, you know, bit or premise or whatever. I'm like, nah, and then they'll just kill it. I'm like, ah, the darkness that just eats them. I get it. But I'm like, hey, come on. You want to be in front of huge audiences and famous and making really good money and enjoying your life? Or do you want to just be toiling again in the, you know, mind pits of,
right,
you know, oblivion stand-up?
Yeah.
It's not selling. And, you know, like, everybody's selling out. I'm like, I've written for Tom Arnold, you know, professional idiot, moron, yeah, born to the role. I've written for Dennis Miller, super arcane, intellectual, then became a right-wing zealot, freak job. I've written for Kilborn, you know, who was a frat boy who had no sense of humor, but was really good on camera. And the writing staff was amazing. It was so much fun to write. And I've written for Wanda Sykes. I don't care.
Right.
If you are a comedy writer and you have breadth, you know, it doesn't matter. There's no morality to comedy. It's not selling out. Maybe this isn't my humor for this project, but then the next one is like, oh my God, like, writing for Dennis Miller was awesome because you could write politics and social issues. And he would add the ugliness on his own. We didn't write that.
But it's cool too. Well, that's also, I think, a thing that people don't understand. Like, that's so similar to copywriting in a lot of ways. Like, my favorite part about marketing is the copywriting, because to me, it makes the writing easier. It's like, I know what my own writing voice is. And sometimes I think too much about that if I'm writing a piece from my own name. But if I'm writing from someone else's name, it's so easy for me to read that person and know their speaking cadence. If there's just one word off that they say, that's not what other people would say. Like, one of my clients says "you all" instead of "y'all." So I always write that in, because I know that's like a weird thing about his speech. Writing for someone else is so fun, because you get to just watch them learn their cadence. You understand we're already judgmental. You may as well use that to just understand the psyche of that person a little bit. And then you get to just come up with all these jokes that you yourself would never get to tell, but they get to do it. And it works because you copywrote it for them, for lack of a better phrase. And I don't know. I think that's a really cool thing.
And again, I think it goes back to having professional experience. Like, that's a professional's attitude. You're going to help this person get their best stuff out there, because that's what they're paying you to do.
Right.
And as a comedy writer, it's the same thing. You're getting paid to help people, whatever they choose, to make it as funny as you possibly can. That's what they've hired you to do. And you're okay with that. There's always restrictions. There's always crazy stuff in every assignment. And again, stand-up is horrible training for people trying to make a living and becoming professional entertainment.
Yeah.
Because it is a control freak, and you get control over it all. And that never happens in entertainment, and you shouldn't expect it. And if it frustrates you, it's not the game for you. You know, go be an artist and just talk to your dog. But, you know, getting some training and be able to emotionally accept that and being okay with that is important, you know, and most stand-ups don't really get that until suddenly they're thrown into a professional entertainment situation and they're not ready. They don't have the skills to do group work, to adapt, to, you know, eat shit while you're sitting there going, this person isn't funny. And they're telling me to get rid of this. I'm like, yeah, it's the game.
Yeah.
They're also giving you a $5,000 check every week. So.
Right. Yeah.
But, well, cool. This has been super fun. I knew it would be. I'm gonna grab you again in a while, and you can tell me more and more about what's happening as the scene evolves.
I'd love that.
And your career evolves and all that good stuff.
I feel like I have like my comedy dads just like all watching to see what Allison's gonna do. There's like a crew of people that are just like, we'll see how your career evolves every 6 months. Let's go.
Yeah. Well, you know, I spent when I was your age. How old are you?
I'm 26.
Yeah. When I was your age, I was doing biker bars. I was doing Florida. Like, I was doing all the shitty, but paid.
Yeah.
B room, whatever shitty gigs throughout Florida and some up and down through the Eastern Seaboard. And so that was my world of learning this stuff. Like,
yeah,
it was me and two other comics who got thrown together into some crazy, literally biker bar that you walked into. And it's like, oh God, what's going to happen tonight? And I learned, you know, from that kind of scene, and you're coming through a different scene. And if you'd lived in LA or New York, it'd be a different scene, but it's super fascinating to watch somebody move through it, especially somebody like you that's you know, you're somewhat analytical about it. You're aware, you're working hard, you're trying to absorb and get better and better. And so it's fun to watch.
It's fun to go through. And it's fun, like, being a few years in. I mean, I still call myself a baby because I am in by industry standards, but it's also cool to see the people that started after me. I always thought about that when I was the newest kid. I was like, damn, I can't wait till I'm like not the newest one anymore. And now I'm like the asshole who goes, well, that open mic's back. I didn't know. And they're like, yeah, because you have other shit to do besides come to open mics. Like, that's true. And so it's nice to like also just have watched the community as like the bottom tier person. And then being like, I can't wait until I'm that next step up. And then after that, it's that one. And it's kind of like Sam Morril said this on a podcast. He was like, comedy is judged on the quality of your complaints year after year. He was like, one year you're like, man, I can't get any of these clubs to get me to host. And then the next year you're like, man, none of the clubs I like want me to host. And then you're like, man, none of the clubs want me to feature. He's like, as long as your complaints are better this year than they were last year, you're probably doing okay. And I was like, huh, it's a very pessimistic way to look at it, but it's not wrong. You know?
Yeah. I used to, you know, when you talk to civilians about stand-up sometimes, it's so funny because they know so little about the actual experience of what it is. And I used to tell people, they'd be like, oh, that must be super fun, you know, go to headline a club. I'm like, well, kind of here's what becomes the problem for stand-ups is if you go into a club and it's super easy and they're laughing at everything, it's not any fun, because then you're just like, ah, it's not the quality of what I'm doing. And if they're not laughing enough, then you're like, they're stupid. They don't get any of this stuff.
Right.
There's almost no sweet spot.
Yeah. It's also funny. Like, I've 9 times out of 10, you tell someone you do stand up that isn't in the world and they say, tell me a joke. And then the 1 time out of 10 that they don't say that, they ask you, where do you perform? And every single time I'm just like, no, I won't tell you a joke. And also anywhere that books me, we're not picky. Just let me get on stage. It doesn't work. Like, I get to choose where I'm performing. It's like, yeah. No,
well, this week, I think maybe I'll work the improv.
Yeah. I think I'll hit up the store, go to the cellar next week. Like, oh, just whatever. We're not all Dave Chappelle. We can't do that.
Yeah. Well, cool. Thanks for jumping on. Super fun. Promote your podcast again. Let people know where to go.
Yeah, thank you. It's Detox with Allison. It's spelled D-E-T-A-L-K-S. Detox with Allison, because I make comedians take vitamin IVs while they talk to me. And that's on anywhere you listen, Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, all those places. And also on YouTube, on the Big Laugh Comedy YouTube channel. All the episodes are on blcomedy.com. And then my Instagram is at Alliwo, A-L-L-I-W-O. That's also my website, alliwo.com. So that's where I'm at.
Yeah, you can find, come on. Like, I always think, you know, like, people, oh, you should market. I'm like, hey, they can find it. How hard is it to, you know, everything is, Google makes us, our
my
stupidity
last name makes
perfectly
it a little
functional.
My last name makes it a little challenging, but that's why everything's Alliwo, A-L-L-I-W-O. It's all that. The day I made my website, I bought my first name, last name at .com. And I was like, I have to buy Alliwo.com too. No one's typing this shit in.
I think so, for sure. Well, cool. I'll come back around. We'll talk again. Everybody, that's been Allison Voidovich.
Yep.
Damn, I can't believe I said that right.
Got it.
Voidovich. Allison Voidovich here in Austin, Texas. Go see her do comedy. Go check out her podcast. Go check out all her stuff. And we will come back around again for the next episode of Rhetoric Warriors. Get out there and get some training and persuasion. It's complicated times. You people can use it. I'll see you next time.